I'm Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, the history of special prosecutors in America hired to investigate presidents and their close associates, and a look ahead to how much of the Mueller report we might actually get to see. We'll spend this hour with law professor Andrew Cohen, who can tell us about which leaders have fired those prosecutors or tried to, and about why the question of whether a president can obstruct justice while in the White House is still up for debate, nearly 150 years after the first special counsel started work. Our conversation starts after a short break. On 2 years since Robert Mueller was appointed to conduct a special investigation into whether anyone associated with Donald Trump's presidential campaign coordinated with Russian efforts to interfere with the election. It feels like a long time, but in fact, the Mueller probe has moved very quickly by historic standards. And unlike the special counsel hired to look into President Nixon's affairs and President Truman's and President Grant's, Robert Mueller has been allowed to keep his job throughout the investigation. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. The Mueller report, when it's released, might vindicate the president himself, or it might implicate him. It's hard to draw any conclusions yet because the Mueller team has been remarkably leak-resistant thus far. And what we get to see as members of the public may depend on how much Attorney General William Barr chooses to make public. Barr has already said he won't be recusing himself from overseeing the Mueller probe, despite writing a memo before he was appointed AG, arguing President Trump's firing of James Comey was not obstruction of justice. Andrew Cohen is a good person to talk to about all this. He is professor of law at the University of Arizona and author of a book called Prosecuting the President: How Special Prosecutors Hold Presidents Accountable and Protect the Rule of Law. He joins us from Arizona Public Media in Tucson. Andrew, welcome to Think.
Thanks so much for having me.
What are the signs that indicate the Mueller team may be approaching its conclusion?
There have been a number of recent news reports suggesting that is the case. That's the clearest sign. Just before the end of his tenure as acting attorney general, Matthew Whitaker also issued a public statement to that effect. Those stories are actually a little puzzling to people who have been watching the investigation closely because it really seems like there are a lot of loose ends still out there I would have expected Robert Mueller to tie up before wrapping up his investigation and issuing his final report. So what we have to go on at this point is news reports citing to anonymous inside sources.
Well, it's interesting because Peter Baker of The New York Times says the Mueller team has been so leak-proof that it makes him feel like a bad reporter. Have special prosecutors historically played their cards this close to the vest?
Mueller is pretty unusual in that respect. Most special prosecutors historically have behaved ethically and responsibly. The popular caricature of special prosecutors as power-mad partisan zealots out to get the president is largely a feature of presidential propaganda. But even by the relatively high historical standards of ethical conduct maintained by special prosecutors over the course of American history, Mueller really does stand out for the extent to which he's been able to tamp down on leaks from inside his investigative team.
The Constitution delineates impeachment as a potential remedy for serious presidential misconduct, but it does not outline how such allegations should be investigated. How was the precedent set that a special prosecutor would be hired in these situations?
The first special prosecutor was appointed by President Ulysses S. Grant in 1875 to investigate a corruption and bribery scandal involving his close friends and associates, in particular his much-beloved chief of staff, Orville Babcock, who had worked for him since Grant's days as the General-in-Chief of the U.S. Army in the Civil War. When Babcock was implicated in this scandal, President Grant hit upon the idea of appointing an outside prosecutor, someone not part of the ordinary chain of command at the U.S. Department of Justice, to investigate the matter as a way of signaling his commitment to get to the bottom of these allegations.
So, in other words, even if this is my good friend, I care as much about the rule of law as anybody else, and this is a sign, Grant was saying, that I want to make that very clear.
That's right. When he appointed John Henderson, Missouri Senator John Henderson, actually former Missouri Senator John Henderson, as the first U.S. special prosecutor in U.S. history, Grant gave the memorable directive, "Let no guilty man escape."
Grant also became the first president to fire a special prosecutor. What happened?
That's right. John Henderson indiscreetly suggested in his closing argument at the trial of one of the conspirators in what was known as the St. Louis Whiskey Ring, that maybe Grant himself was involved in the corruption and bribery that Henderson was appointed to investigate. And when Grant got word of this, he lost his temper. He had been primed by his partisan allies to think that Henderson's investigation had become a kind of covert effort to undermine his administration. And when he heard about Henderson's comments before the jury as part of his closing argument, he immediately directed that Henderson be fired.
We know that Richard Nixon's indirect firing of Archibald Cox had huge consequences for his presidency. Why didn't that reflect badly on Grant?
Grant, like Nixon, immediately appointed a replacement for John Henderson, a second special prosecutor. But the political norms, the standards of presidential conduct in Grant's day were much different, much less well-developed than they were by the time of Richard Nixon's presidency. Corruption and graft were par for the course, and most Americans were very cynical about the idea that high public officials, much less a president, could ever be held legally accountable for breaking the law. That made it very difficult for people who might have been upset by the Whiskey Ring scandal or Grant's interference with the investigation of that scandal to mobilize and hold Grant politically accountable.
Why did Harry Truman fire a special prosecutor?
That is an interesting story. Harry Truman, towards the very end of his presidency, was forced by public pressure to appoint a special prosecutor to investigate a bribery scandal in both the Tax Division of the Justice Department and the Bureau of Internal Revenue, which was the predecessor to the modern IRS. And the man he settled upon, actually the man whom Truman's Attorney General, Howard McGrath, settled upon, was named Newbold Morris. He was a crusading anti-corruption lawyer from New York City who was an experienced lawyer and an experienced investigator, but a Washington neophyte. And he made a huge number of enemies and repeatedly put his foot in his mouth in the early weeks of the investigation and really managed to alienate almost all of the Justice Department employees that he was supposed to investigate, to the point where it was virtually impossible for him to conduct an effective investigation. Truman found himself in an awkward position. He needed to signal his seriousness about getting to the bottom of these allegations, but the man his attorney general had appointed was not well cut out for that job. There's some indication that Howard McGrath may actually have deliberately appointed Newbold Morris because he knew that he would not be, that Morris would not be an effective investigator, and McGrath hoped to take advantage of Morris's reputation as an anti-corruption crusader to effectively hide what was going on in the Justice Department and the Bureau of Revenue at the time. In the end, both McGrath and Newbold Morris lost their jobs. This was the sort of compromise solution that Harry Truman came up with He had an ineffective special prosecutor, and he had an attorney general who was clearly not cooperating with that special prosecutor's investigation and may have appointed the special prosecutor as an attempt to cover up wrongdoing in his own department. So he fired both of them.
Is a presidential administration required by law to appoint a special prosecutor in certain situations, or is it a matter of just adhering to custom to demonstrate, again, that respect for the rule of law?
From 1978 to 1999, the Attorney General, who works for the president, was in fact required by law to appoint what was then called an independent counsel to investigate if credible evidence was presented to the Justice Department showing wrongdoing by the president or other high-level executive branch officials. But since that law, which was called the Ethics in Government Act, expired after the Bill Clinton impeachment proceedings, there has been no law which requires the president to appoint a special counsel, no matter how serious the charges are that he or his top advisors might be facing. And prior to the adoption of the Ethics in Government Act in 1978, there was no law requiring a president to appoint a special counsel. It has, for most of American history, been political pressure to signal the president's commitment to getting to the bottom of the charges against him or his high-level advisors, which has led to the appointment of special prosecutors.
The way special prosecutors carry out their work has changed over time. They've been accountable to different people. Can you talk about how it happened that Ken Starr did not answer to the Attorney General in the Clinton administration?
Yes, and that story begins actually with the Watergate special prosecutor investigation of Richard Nixon. In the fall of 1973, Richard Nixon fired the first Watergate special prosecutor, Archibald Cox, or rather ordered his attorney general to fire the special prosecutor. He had to go through two attorney generals before he found a third one who would actually carry out that order. And that episode, which became known as the Saturday Night Massacre, made a lot of people very nervous. Nixon was ultimately forced to appoint, by political pressure, was forced to appoint a second special prosecutor whose investigation led to Nixon's resignation. But after Watergate, a lot of members of Congress were uncomfortable with the president's ability to fire a special prosecutor and the discretion that a president enjoyed about whether to appoint a special prosecutor in the first instance. And so to guard against the risk of a repeat of the Saturday Night Massacre, to guard against the possibility that some future president might effectively shut down a special prosecutor investigation of his own conduct, Congress passed the Ethics in Government Act, which established a kind of super strong statutory special prosecutor called the Independent Counsel. Ken Starr was appointed under the Independent Counsel statute, which meant that the Attorney General was obligated to call for the appointment of a special prosecutor, called an independent counsel under that statute, when presented with credible evidence that the president or his high-level advisors had been engaged in wrongdoing. And also, the statute in question prohibited the attorney general or the president from firing the independent counsel, in this case Kenneth Starr, without good cause, which basically is a legal term of art that means without a very good reason. That standard has a long history in American law and is actually quite a bit more robust than it sounds. And this prohibition on removing an independent counsel without good cause is what made Ken Starr effectively unaccountable to President Clinton or his Attorney General, Janet Reno. Under the Independent Counsel statute, in fact, if the Attorney General tried to remove the Independent Counsel for good cause, the Independent Counsel was permitted to seek judicial review of that decision before a special panel of judges on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals.
So fair to say, Kenneth Starr, when he was special investigator, was effectively untouchable.
He was much less accountable to the president than other special prosecutors have been for most of American history.
All right.
He enjoyed robust legal protection for his tenure, which no other special prosecutor in U.S. history has enjoyed.
Andrew Cohen is my guest. We're talking about his book, Prosecuting the President. Listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Andrew Cohen, who's professor of law at the University of Arizona and author of Prosecuting the President, How Special Prosecutors Hold Presidents Accountable and Protect the Rule of Law. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think at kera.org, or you can find us on Twitter at keratHink. Andrew, after all was said and done, even Kenneth Starr supported a change in how investigations would be structured, or at least allowed wanted to allow for the law as it had existed when he was operating to expire. Is that right?
That is right. And before I explain or elaborate on that, I need to correct a misstatement that I made just before the break. I said that Ken Starr was the only special prosecutor in U.S. history who had enjoyed the strong tenure protections that we were discussing. And that's actually not right. He was one of several special prosecutors appointed under the Independent Counsel Statute, which was in effect from 1978 to 1999. But that was the only period in U.S. history when special prosecutors enjoyed that kind of strong tenure protection. Except for those 20 years, presidents have had the discretion to decide whether to appoint a special prosecutor in the first instance, and also the power to decide whether to remove a special prosecutor. After the conclusion of his investigation, Ken Starr supported a return to that system and opposed the renewal of the independent counsel statute under which he had been appointed, on the theory that even special prosecutors can abuse their power, and that for that reason, it's very important that special prosecutors remain accountable to some elected official, in this case, the president, who is constitutionally empowered to supervise the law enforcement operations of the federal government.
Does Congress have any power to reinstate a prosecutor who is dismissed from his or her investigation?
Congress does not have that power. Congress has considered over the course of the past 2 years a number of legislative proposals which would restore some of the protections that independent counsels enjoyed during that 20-year period following Watergate and ending with the Clinton impeachment. In particular, Congress has considered bills which would prohibit the Attorney General from removing Robert Mueller or other special counsels except for good cause in an effort to guard against a repeat of the Saturday Night Massacre, which has seemed like an all too real possibility during much of the past 2 years, given President Trump's obvious displeasure with the Mueller investigation and given his reported attempts to shut that investigation down at various points.
What do we know about how much President Trump has wanted to fire Robert Mueller and how the extent to which he's taken action in that direction or tried to?
Well, I would just direct your listeners to the president's Twitter feed. He has expressed his views about the Mueller investigation, I think, hundreds of times, certainly in excess of 100 times over the course of the past 2 years on his Twitter feed. Credible media reports have suggested that President Trump ordered Mueller removed and his investigation shut down at least twice during the period during which Mueller has been conducting that investigation. Those reports have been disputed by the White House. But whether or not those reports are accurate, the president's public statements, most notably on Twitter, have clearly evinced his disdain for the investigation and his desire that Attorney General Jeff Sessions or Attorney General Rod Rosenstein or their successors would step in and shut down this investigation, which he has seen from the beginning is very politically damaging to his presidency.
I think it's fair to say no president is delighted when a special prosecutor is poking around looking for evidence of wrongdoing. What would happen to the investigation if a lead investigator, someone like a Robert Mueller, were fired? Does the probe just go away?
No, it would take more than the simple dismissal of Robert Mueller to shut down an investigation. But we would really be in pretty uncharted territory at that point. Robert Mueller is conducting his investigation under a set of fairly elaborate regulations, which were adopted by the Justice Department after the Clinton impeachment, in effect to replace the independent counsel statute, which had been allowed to expire in 1999. And no special prosecutor conducting an investigation under those regulations, which vest the special counsel with all of the powers of a U.S. attorney, which is the title of an ordinary federal prosecutor, has ever been fired. So we don't really know exactly what would happen in the aftermath of such a dismissal.
So let's talk about what happens when the special prosecutor's report is complete. Attorney General William Barr will be the first one to receive the report. Is that right?
That is correct.
Okay. And then Barr's office also decides how much of that report would be made public. How does that process work, and how long might we expect it to take to go through what could be hundreds of pages of documents and writing, right?
This is another case where we are really in uncharted territory. The Mueller investigation is the first significant investigation conducted under the special counsel regulations adopted in 1999. The only other investigation conducted under those regulations was former Senator John Danforth's investigation of the Waco standoff between federal agents and heavily armed members of the Branch Davidian religious sect. When Janet Reno appointed former Senator Danforth to conduct that investigation, she explicitly directed him to produce a public report. Rod Rosenstein's appointment of Robert Mueller was not accompanied by any such directive, so the only rules which govern both the contents of Mueller's report and the public release of that report are those codified in the 1999 regulations, and those regulations are being road tested for the first time in the Mueller investigation. What I think we can say is this, that Attorney General Barr will review the Mueller report. He will consider various Justice Department policies and regulations which might be construed to prohibit release of that report, then make some kind of decision. But there is really no clear precedent governing or providing a governing standard for the Attorney General's decision about how much to disclose. The other piece of information that we have here to go on is Barr's testimony at his Senate confirmation hearings, but that testimony was very equivocal. On the one hand, he said he strongly supported transparency and thought it was vitally important for the American people to have a credible resolution of the matters that Mueller is investigating. On the other hand, he repeatedly refused to commit to releasing the full report and emphasized department regulations which could be read to require the suppression of all information about the president.
So, yeah, what would be the legal justification for redacting information about the president that might be contained in the Mueller report? And we should be clear, once again, we don't know that there will be anything incriminating about the president of the United States in the completed Mueller report.
Very important to be clear about that, I think. And we actually don't know what form the Mueller report will take. The regulations are pretty spare on this point, too. They simply require the special prosecutor to submit a confidential report to the attorney general explaining his prosecution and what are called declination decisions, his decisions not to bring charges. That kind of an explanation could be very short in theory. I think there's some fairly good reason to believe that Mueller or any prosecutor in his position, having conducted a an investigation of this kind of length and scope, would be inclined to provide a more thorough explanation of his conclusions. But we really don't know exactly how Robert Mueller is going to choose to approach this report. When he files the report, there are some Justice Department regulations, as you suggested, which could be read to require the suppression of information about the president. Generally, the Justice Department does not explain its decisions not to bring charges against individuals who have been under investigation. And it also has a policy against the disclosure of derogatory information about uncharged persons. The Justice Department finally has another policy which prohibits Robert Mueller from indicting or bringing charges against a sitting president, which means that almost certainly this investigation is not going to end with charges against the president. And in light of that fact, these other two regulations I mentioned could be construed to prohibit Attorney General Barr from releasing any derogatory information about the president or releasing any information about Robert Mueller's decision not to prosecute the president, even if Mueller's report says he chose not to prosecute the president because of the Justice Department policy and that he in fact had evidence or had probable cause to believe that the president had broken the law. So those are the policies that Barr might cite in support of a decision to suppress some or all of the Mueller report. There are, on the other hand, significant historical precedents when the Justice Department has chosen to disclose substantial information and has made public substantial reports explaining its decision not to bring charges in particular cases including derogatory information about individuals who were not charged. The two most salient recent examples of that are the report released after the Justice Department's civil rights investigation of the shooting death of Michael Brown at the hands of police in Ferguson, Missouri, and John Danforth's investigation of the Waco standoff, which culminated in the release of a very substantial public report which explained Danforth's decision not to bring criminal charges against the FBI officials involved, although it cast some of those officials in a pretty negative light.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. What does the Constitution say about the circumstances in which a president can be subject to a criminal indictment, and why characterize the nature of the debate that exists that remains in constitutional law circles over that question?
The Constitution says precisely nothing about when a sitting president can be charged with a crime. It does implicitly suggest that a president who is impeached and removed from office can be charged with a crime after the end of the president's official tenure. But it doesn't say anything about whether charges can be brought against a sitting president. The main argument against the constitutionality of bringing criminal charges against a sitting president is that the Constitution makes impeachment the exclusive means for removing the president and other high federal officials from office, and that scheme would be subverted if a special prosecutor or anybody else representing the Justice Department could charge a president with a crime, because bringing criminal charges against a president would effectively disable him from being able to carry out his official functions. The argument in favor of the constitutionality of charging a sitting president with a crime is that there is a long tradition in the United States, a deep commitment to the ideal of equal justice under law and to the idea that no person, not even the president, is above the law, and that we should be very loath to compromise that principle when the Constitution doesn't say anything directly on this point.
Assuming that Attorney General Barr releases the Mueller report in a highly redacted form or not at all, how much of that report do the president and his lawyers get to see?
That is not a question that the special counsel regulations speak to. At his Senate confirmation hearings, Barr declared unequivocally that the president and his lawyers would not be permitted to edit the report before portions of that report were disclosed to Congress or to the public. But there is no official set of regulations or policies which determines whether or to what extent the Attorney General can share Robert Mueller's report with the president and his lawyers.
Does Congress have the power to subpoena a fully complete copy of the report?
They can certainly try. Court decisions have upheld Congress's investigatory authority have upheld Congress's authority to issue subpoenas as part of that authority. The executive branch and the Attorney General will have a variety of arguments that they can raise in opposition to or as part of an attempt to resist any congressional subpoena. There is no clear precedent, certainly no clear precedent in any U.S. Supreme Court decision, which can tell us with any certainty how a court would be likely to resolve that kind of dispute.
One has to imagine that if Congress got a copy of the report, there would be significant leakage.
If Congress got a copy of the report, there is, I think, a very high probability that most or all of that report would make its way into the public domain. That's exactly what happened with Kenneth Starr's 445-page report on the Monica Lewinsky affair, which triggered impeachment proceedings against Bill Clinton. That report was filed in the first instance confidentially with Congress, but House Republicans quickly voted to release the entire report to the general public. It's quite possible the Democrats in the House of Representatives would take the same steps, although I think there is a very strong chance that the report will contain some information which should be redacted before the report is released to the public.
My guest is University of Arizona law professor Andrew Cohen. We're talking about his book, Prosecuting the President, How Special Prosecutors Hold Presidents Accountable and Protect the Rule of Law. Listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with University of Arizona Professor of Law Andrew Cohen. His book is Prosecuting the President, How Special Prosecutors Hold Presidents Accountable and Protect the Rule of Law. If you'd like to join us, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372 or find us on Twitter at KERAThink. Andrew, what should we make of the aspects of this investigation that the Special Prosecutor's Office has handed off to other jurisdictions like the New York State Attorney General?
Special prosecutors, unlike ordinary federal prosecutors, have limited jurisdiction. That means that they are only empowered to investigate particular issues or crimes or, in some cases, persons. And when Robert Mueller was appointed, his jurisdiction was limited to investigating possible links or coordination between Donald Trump's 2016 presidential campaign and the Russian government, and any matters that might arise directly out of that investigation. So if Mueller turns up evidence of a crime which does not arise directly out of his investigation of possible collusion in the 2016 presidential campaign, he has two options. He can either ignore that information or he can hand off that information to other federal prosecutors who have the authority to investigate it. And we know of several instances in which he has chosen the latter course.
Hmm. Were there no such limits placed on Kenneth Starr in the Clinton investigation? Because he started looking into this complicated real estate deal, people may remember the phrase Whitewater, and ended up, we ended up having the president you know, impeached over this question of whether he lied about having a sexual affair with a woman who worked in his office.
It's a little bit complicated. Kenneth Starr's investigation lasted for a long time. He was initially authorized to investigate possible financial misconduct as part of the Whitewater land deal in Arkansas. But his authority was expanded several times during the course of his investigation to unrelated matters, formally expanded to those matters, not because Kenneth Starr simply began to investigate them and arrogated that authority to himself, but rather he obtained official authorization from the three-judge panel, which appointed him under the independent counsel statute to investigate those additional matters. His investigation, his decision to investigate the Monica Lewinsky matter was probably the single most controversial decision that he made as a special prosecutor, and his rationale for making it was that the arrangement of a job for Monica Lewinsky in exchange for her silence about her romantic relationship with the president was sufficiently similar to some other hush money payments that Starr was investigating as part of the Whitewater land deal that it fell within the special counsel's or the independent counsel's authority. A lot of people have questioned that decision, and I think Ken Starr himself has even expressed regret about taking on the investigation of the Monica Lewinsky affair.
All right, so let's talk about this unsolicited memo that William Barr, who is now Attorney General, wrote before he was Attorney General of the United States, arguing that a president can't obstruct justice in the course of his duties as a president. Do I have that right?
You do.
Some people have argued that represents its own conflict of interest with regard to the Mueller investigation, or at least betrays a bias. Is that argument likely to carry any weight in terms of requiring Barr or pressuring Barr to recuse himself from taking any direct action when the Mueller report is released?
It has not caused him to recuse himself, and apparently it did not cause the senior ethics lawyers in the Justice Department to recommend recusal in his case, if news reports from the last week or two are to be believed.
All right. Let's assume, for the sake of argument, that the Mueller report does not present any evidence of wrongdoing by the president. Would that be sufficient? This is not a legal question, but just I'm looking for your sense of the pulse of the American people. Would that be sufficient to exonerate him in the minds of the American public?
I don't have a sufficient sense of the pulse of the American people that I feel like I can answer that question confidently. I don't think it should exonerate him because we will know what Robert Mueller has found. We will see the conclusions of the Mueller investigation only despite the president's best efforts to shut that investigation down. If that means that the rule of law has survived, that the president has been thoroughly investigated, it will only have survived against the president's best efforts to undermine it. And I think that is reason for President Trump to suffer lasting censure, maybe not formal censure by Congress, but that the American people ought and at the very least, at the next presidential election, we'll have an opportunity to think about that and decide whether this is the kind of behavior that we are willing to tolerate in a president.
You mentioned the president's Twitter feed. He's made a number of statements in public to television reporters and on Twitter that appear to demonstrate that he fired James Comey in part due to that investigation that Comey was conducting of alleged Russian meddling. Could those statements, things that are not made under oath, be used against him in the context of the Mueller investigation?
They could be used against him. Most attempts to obstruct justice in violation of federal law are not made under oath. In fact, I think it's probably safe to say that almost none of them are made under oath. The question that arises in this context, there are a couple of questions. First, are President Trump's public statements fairly read to indicate that he fired James Comey in order to shut down the Russia investigation? I think there's a plausible reading, especially of his famous interview with Lester Holt on NBC News, that in fact suggests that that was his motivation for firing James Comey. But his defenders point to comments later in the interview which suggest that he genuinely believed that Comey was unfit for the position of FBI director and that he fired him, recognizing that his decision to do so might actually prolong the Russia investigation, that he did it anyway in order to restore effective leadership, or what he perceived to be effective leadership, at the FBI. So that's one set of questions. Do the president's public statements actually show that he fired Comey or took any other action in order to shut down the Russia investigation? The second question is the one that you alluded to earlier in connection with Attorney General William Barr's memo written in June of 2018 addressing the question of obstruction of justice. And that is the question of whether a president is capable of obstructing justice when exercising his official duties, his constitutional authority, for example, to fire the FBI director or to order the attorney general to drop a particular investigation. William Barr, in his June 2018 memorandum, argued that a president has unlimited authority under Article 2 of the Constitution to fire the FBI director for whatever reason and to direct the Department of Justice's investigative operations and to shut down an investigation for any reason, and that he cannot commit the crime of obstruction of justice when he is exercising those constitutional authorities. That, in my view, is mistaken, and I think it is fairly described as an extreme view of executive power. And I think the clearest indication that it's mistaken is that it implies that Richard Nixon did not obstruct justice during the Watergate affair. In particular, it implies Richard Nixon did not obstruct justice on the famous smoking gun tape, which was released in the summer of 1974 and showed Richard Nixon ordering his chief of staff to direct the CIA to shut down the FBI's Watergate investigation. Richard Nixon clearly had the constitutional authority to supervise the CIA and to supervise the FBI and to give directions to the CIA and to give directions to the FBI. And yet, when that tape became public in the summer of 1974, Richard Nixon was forced to resign within days because everyone, even congressional Republicans who had voted against impeachment just a few weeks before, agreed that Nixon's conduct amounted to obstruction of justice. And if that's the case, then President Trump can obstruct justice by firing the FBI director, and President Trump can obstruct justice by seeking to interfere with or undermine or ordering the shutdown of the Justice Department's investigation of collusion with Russia or between Russia and his 2016 presidential campaign.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Just so we can all understand this, why would it be within the president's authority to obstruct justice? I mean, what is a sort of innocent context or a necessary context in which we need to preserve the president's power to obstruct justice?
I think the question is not whether the president needs the power to obstruct justice. It is whether the president needs the power to make final decisions about everything that happens within the executive branch. And the position of people like Attorney General William Barr, who is a very good lawyer and a thoughtful man, is that the president's authority to supervise the executive branch, his authority to supervise federal law enforcement, his constitutional duty to take care that the laws be faithfully executed, gives him final and unlimited authority to make decisions about whether the FBI director should be fired or whether particular investigations should be continued or dropped, and that it would be very dangerous to permit the criminal investigation of the president's exercise of those authorities, since by virtue of his office, it's the president who gets to decide what counts as good cause for removing an FBI director. And it's the president who gets to decide when a particular investigation is in the public interest, and that nobody has any business second-guessing the judgment of an elected president on those types of decisions.
You said that regardless of the outcome of this particular investigation, the Mueller investigation, we should consider it a victory for the rule of law if Robert Mueller is, as we can assume he will be, allowed to bring it to its conclusion without interference. Can you tell us why you feel that way?
The rule of law demands that the president, like any other person, be held accountable if he breaks the law. We can put it simply, no one, not even the president, is above the law. And to honor that principle requires that credible allegations of law breaking against the president be seriously and thoroughly investigated. At every step since Robert Mueller's appointment to investigate the credible allegations of collusion between President Trump's 2016 campaign and the Russian government, President Trump has tried to thwart that investigation, including in public tweets, attempting to shame Rod Rosenstein and Attorney General Jeff Sessions into ending the investigation. And he has thus far failed to do so. That is a pretty remarkable feat that Robert Mueller has accomplished. And it's a feat which I think he has only been able to accomplish with the support of the American people. It's political pressure that has prevented the president from firing Robert Mueller. And if Mueller gets to deliver his report, that will be a victory for the rule of law, because it will demonstrate that the president's alleged crimes have been seriously investigated.
Andrew Cohen is professor of law at the University of Arizona and author of Prosecuting the President: How Special Prosecutors Hold Presidents Accountable and Protect the Rule of Law. Andrew, thanks so much for spending this time with us.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure.